Well, this is Fight the Empire. My name is Per Fagrang, and my guest is Michael Shermer, who is the founding publisher of The Skeptic Magazine, a columnist for Scientific American, and the author of a very interesting book called The Believing Brain, From Ghosts and Gods to Politics and Conspiracies. And I think that's where we're going to kind of end up on, in the sense that's what this show is about. But anyway, Michael Shermer, welcome to KBOO.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, why don't we start out with sort of your basic building block for your book is these experiments and what you call patternicity and agenticity.
Yeah, so, you know, my first book was Why People Believe Weird Things, and in The Believing Brain, I want to understand why people believe things, period, full stop, and begins with this idea of what I call patternicity, the tendency to find meaningful patterns in both meaningful and meaningless noise. So I'm less interested in why people see the face of Jesus on the side of a building or the Virgin Mary in a grilled cheese sandwich or something like that, although that's important to understand why that happens. But the reason it happens is because we find patterns of all kinds, and a lot of times patterns are real. So the problem is telling the difference between real and non-real or true and false patterns. So I start off with a thought experiment. Imagine you're a hominid on the plains of Africa 3.5 million years ago, and you hear a rustle in the grass. Is it a dangerous predator, or is it just the wind? Now, if you assume that it's a dangerous predator and it turns out it's just the wind, you've made a type one error, a false positive, but no harm. It's a low-cost error to make. You just become more vigilant and cautious. But if you assume that the wind is just that the rustle in the grass is just the wind, and instead it turns out it's a dangerous predator, you're lunch. Congratulations, you've just been given a Darwin Award for taking yourself out of the gene pool. So I begin with the argument that there was a natural selection in favor of making the low-cost error of cognition. That is, just assume all patterns are real just in case, because making the other error is too costly. And therefore, that's the basis of all superstition and magical thinking. In other words, we have to believe things, and weird things are a subset of things.
So like thinking the worst. You're not going to lose by thinking the worst.
That's right, yeah. It's a little bit like the precautionary principle, although I don't always agree with that. Still, that's the principle. In other words, our brains are designed to just assume most things are true. And that's why science is in many ways counterintuitive, because science starts off with the null hypothesis, that we just assume your claim is not true until you prove otherwise, providing us with the evidence and clinical trials and so forth.
So what's agenticity?
Well, so what's the difference between the wind and a dangerous predator? The wind is an inanimate object. A dangerous predator is an intentional agent. So I call this agenticity, the tendency to infuse these patterns with intentional agents. That is, there's a being, an essence, a creature, a being, an agent of some sort that has intention. And in the case of the hominid on the plains of Africa 3.5 million years ago, rustle in the grass, is it the wind or a dangerous predator? A dangerous predator intends to eat me. And that's very different from the wind, an inanimate force. And this is the basis of like animism, spiritism, polytheism, monotheism. The belief in God and gods is a kind of infusion of the patterns that we see in the world with agents, hidden agents, demons and angels and aliens and so forth. These are all kinds of agents. Even conspiracy theories in many ways are type, they're like secret agents operating behind the scenes, invisible. We can't see them, but we know they're out there because we can see their operations at work. And that's how the human mind works. It finds patterns, it infuses the patterns with agency, and that's the basis of most of our beliefs.
Okay, well, what is so science? Now, science sifts through all this data, and then what?
Well, so in science, the idea is to determine, because our brains do not have a baloney detection module built in to help us tell the difference between true patterns and false patterns, we have to have some kind of systematic way of getting at it. So science has developed these very specific techniques of like running an experiment in which you have control group and an experimental group, and you have a dependent variable and an independent variable, and you vary these conditions, and you put one group of subjects in one group and another group of subjects in another group, and you have to randomly select them, and you have to control for other intervening variables, and all that's in there for a particular reason, because we know the world is complex, that there's many factors that could be at work. Yes, you vary the conditions and X happens, but maybe X would have happened under some other set of conditions. We don't know which is the so we have to control for those those things. Then you have to make sure that the subject doesn't know which condition they're in because of the placebo effect. So that's a blinded condition. And then you have to make sure that the experimenter doesn't even know which condition the subject is in. So they have to be coded with letters and numbers and so on, so you don't know who is who and which condition, because we know of the experimenter bias effect. So that's a double blind. That's what it means to have a double-blind experiment. And all those things are in place because of this problem that I call the believing brain. That is, we have all these cognitive biases that help assure us that whatever our beliefs are, they are right. So my thesis of the believing brain is that we start off with the belief, and then we run around gathering data to support it.
Okay, what about historical knowledge? You know, that's not it's very hard to do experiments with history, even though some people think you can. I suppose you could almost say that historical knowledge is based on anecdotal evidence.
It is in many ways, yes.
But it's been systematized and scrutinized and all that.
So it's why in many ways all history is Whiggish history, right? It's what we call the hindsight bias in cognitive psychology. That is, once you know the outcome, it's easy to look back in time and put together a plausible series of events that led to this condition that you're in now, or the way the world is now. I mean, this is the way in many ways autobiography works. Hardly any of us plot out our lives ahead of time and have them turn out that way. Maybe some lawyers or doctors or whatever that always wanted to do that since grade school, and they took all the classes and they end up doing that, and that's all they ever did. Most of us in most places end up doing nothing that we train for. We end up doing something completely different. But when you look back, then you find some plausible causal sequence to make sense of it. Oh, yes, I turned left instead of right that day, and I ended up going to the store, and I met my wife, and then we moved here. I ended up with a job there and this fantastic career, and none of that would have happened if I would turn right instead of left, right? So we can find that turning point. Mm-hmm. But that's only after the fact. All history in that way is Whiggish history.
Well, you give this kind of example of, so I could call it a natural experiment of history, sort of the development of the Dominican Republic and Haiti. These are two countries on the same island.
Right.
They were both kind of slave societies, one run by the Spanish, one by the French, and you sort of trace their history.
Yeah, that's a comparative methodology that Jared Diamond likes to employ, like in Guns, Germs, and Steel, in his new book, The Natural Experiments of History. There, of course, we can't control the conditions experimentally. We can't go in and enslave one group of people and do something with another group. That would be immoral and illegal. So,
and they did something like that with the Zimbardo experiment at Stanford, the prisoners,
yes,
and the guards.
Yes, and they had to stop it. And by the way, you could never get that experiment approved today.
Mm-hmm.
The ethics committees would shoot that down, along with Milgram shock experiments, right? This would never be approved.
But back to Haiti and the Dominican Republic.
Yeah, so there you have natural occurring conditions, you know, just by political history. One group of people is enslaved longer than another. There are geographic differences. One side of the island is on the rain shadow, and the other, so it's drier, and the other is in the sort of rainforest, so it's wetter. Those conditions matter. But mostly just opening up the island to trade and liberalizing it more politically has a dramatic difference on the outcome of the people's prosperity and the environment and how well the rainforest is taken care of and that sort of thing versus being in a pure dictatorship. So there we can actually infer certain principles from history about what's the best way for people to live. I mean, it's not just that my opinion is my belief in democracy is equal to your belief in dictatorships or whatever, and we each have our opinions. No, we can actually test experimentally which condition leads to more freedom and more prosperity for more people more of the time, and that is liberal democracies seem to be much better. We have a good database now that liberal democracies never fight each other. You know, two countries with McDonald's or Starbucks don't go to war with each other, or almost never. And so that at least is some data that we can conclude from this sort of comparison method of history.
Well, I was just thinking the first World War was actually between about 10 or 12 empires. But one thing with the big difference with Haiti was that when they became, you know, they had to fight for their independence. They had to defeat Napoleon's army and all that.
Yeah.
And right away they were socked with a 20 million dollar debt. Of course, $20 million in those days is a lot more. And right. so they spent decades. They were, their whole development was just set back immensely by this basically a bogus debt. They were being forced to pay for the property that they took, namely the slaves.
Right.
And that really set them back, and they never, I don't think they ever really recovered myself.
Yeah, well, there's another variable condition that affects how things turn out.
Didn't happen in the Dominican Republic because they sort of eased into freedom a little more gradually.
Right, yes.
And they didn't arouse fears like even Thomas Jefferson was sort of petrified that slave rebellions might spread, in the United States. But let's talk take a little break here and say that this is Fight the Empire. My guest is Michael Shermer, who is the publisher of Skeptic Magazine, columnist for Scientific American, author of this very interesting book, The Believing Brain. And we're going to talk, I think, a lot of the book has to do with science and knowledge and the mind, the whole mind-brain thing that philosophers are still dealing with. But since this is Fight the Empire, I think I'd like to get on to conspiracy theories.
Yes, yeah, right.
So what's, there are, one thing that troubles me is that some people seem to lump them all together. You know, that if you, somehow they're all in a bag, like say the Martin Luther King assassination is in the same bag with lizards from outer space,
right?
And the Illuminati and that kind of
right.
stuff.
So we have to make a distinction here between conspiracies and conspiracy theories. Conspiracies absolutely happen. The theories may or may not be correct. So, I mean, Lincoln was assassinated by a conspiracy. So it's not like these things can't happen. They do mm-hmm. happen. They happen mm-hmm. all the time. Watergate was a conspiracy. And the assassination of Franz Ferdinand that triggered the First World War, that was a conspiracy by these Serbian nationalists called the Black Hand who wanted to fight for Serbian independence from the Austria-Hungarian Empire. And so they plotted in secret to assassinate Franz Ferdinand. That's a conspiracy that actually did happen. But the difference between that and, say, the 9/11 truthers or the Obama birthers is that we eventually come to understand what happened. People talk. Evidence comes out. We get the notes of the plot, and we find out what happened. In the case of the 9/11 truthers, for example, it doesn't matter how much evidence you present to show that Al-Qaeda did it. They ignore it, or evidence presented against their particular claims, like controlled demolition of the World Trade Center buildings. It just there's not a shred of evidence that this happened, but they don't care. So this is the difference. One of the characteristics of telling true from false conspiracies in my chapter on this, in The Believing Brain, is that if the more components of a conspiracy or the more people that have to be involved, the less likely the theory is to be true, because people are relatively incompetent, and especially in conspiratorial plots, and also people can't keep their mouth shut. We eventually do find out about these things. We see what happens with government agents once they get out of government. They write books. They go on the lecture circuit. They tell all.
Oh, they get assassinated, too. Supposedly, like people who studied the John Kennedy assassination, they claim that several people who did try and spill the beans met very mysterious deaths.
Maybe, but, I've looked into some of those, and I don't think there's anything to those, actually. I mean, of course, people do die. It's like the Tut's curse. If you wait long enough, everybody who went into Tut's tomb died. Well, of course, people die. So I think the case is closed on the JFK thing. I am convinced it's a lone assassin there. But that doesn't mean other conspiracies. We have to take them one by one.
That's what I think. Okay, well, let's go back to World Trade Center. I mean, I don't really feel very well equipped to understand the demolition theory. I'm not an architect or a builder or anything.
Yes, you don't need any of that. I'll tell you how we
But
know.
There are, I do know that there is a group of architects yep. and engineers who
For
do claim that
truth,
it was demolished.
Right. Yeah, I know those guys. I've looked at their claims. I don't think there's mm-hmm. anything to them, not a shred of evidence. You don't need to know anything about explosive devices, how they work, thermite, secret thermite, nano thermite, super nano secret thermite. Forget all that. What are the chances? What are the probabilities of two things happening versus one? Always lower. That is, the probability of two events coming together is going to be lower than either one of them happening by themselves. We know that the planes are flown into the World Trade Center buildings. We have the video proof. We know that the buildings collapsed at the point of impact where the planes hit. You can watch it on the video. So what are the chances that both Al-Qaeda or somebody flew the planes into the building, and somebody secretly plotted to plant explosive devices in the World Trade Center buildings. By the way, two of the most secure buildings in the world. Somehow they had able to do this for weeks on end ahead of time without anybody noticing. But even just assuming that, and they somehow managed to plant the bombs at the exact place where they knew ahead of time where the planes would hit. The probabilities of that are so low that I don't think we have to take that claim seriously at all. That's all you need to know. It's impossible for that to have been pulled off. And again, the way buildings are demolished, you have to go in and break up with hammers the particle board, the walls, so you can get to the steel beams and wrap them in the explosive devices. How would this have been done without anybody noticing? Again, there's, you know, tens of thousands of people work in these buildings. They are covered with guards. And remember, Al-Qaeda tried to blow up the buildings in 1993 with the truck bombs.
Well, actually, what happened there, that particular plot was sort of instigated. The leader of it was this Major Salem, who was an Egyptian army officer, and he rounded up these guys from a mosque in Jersey City. And the FBI knew, I mean, they were aware of this the whole time, that this was going to happen. At one point, Salem asked his handlers that he would like to mix up an explosive that wouldn't explode. He didn't want people to get hurt, and they overruled him. And so, he mixed up a real explosive, and one of the guys parked it down below in the underground garage, and a lot of people got killed. So the FBI was aware of this. They let it happen, and they let it happen in sort of the worst way.
Well, I would have to disagree with you on that. I mean, just if that's true, what else has to be true? That means that people in the FBI, a federal government agency, knew about this and let it happen, which means that who are these people? Why are they not on trial? Why have we not investigated them? Why have they not been fired? These are pretty dramatic accusations that would be criminal charges. Why are these people not criminally charged if that's true? I mean, certainly the government has no qualms about charging people for crimes like that. They do it all the time. We have the highest prison rate in the world. Our government locks up people like crazy. Why would they not? And they don't spare anybody in government either. They lock up people from government agents that do illegal things. This happens all the time. So that's why I'm skeptical.
I have a story here. This is in the Los Angeles Times, October 28, 1993. From a Reuters story. And the first paragraph says, law enforcement officials plan to thwart the bombing of the World Trade Center by substituting harmless powder for explosives, but the scheme was called off by the FBI, a newspaper reported today. Oh, I guess the New York Times reported this first. But anyway, I mean, this is the story, and they go on from there, give more details about it. There's apparently tapes where this Major Salem said that he's, didn't.
Okay, but why has no one followed up on it? I mean, if that's true.
Well, that's a good question.
but again, I mean, the government doesn't shy away from stories like that. They go after people with a vengeance.
Well, it depends who does it.
Yes, well, okay, so how can we tell the difference between the true conspiracies that are prosecuted and those that are not? And if they're not, why not? I mean, so you can't just say, well, people were killed or the men in black came and made people be quiet or whatever, because that's not really an explanation. Mm-hmm. It's just a explanation for why we don't have any evidence for our conspiracy theory. It's a little bit like, that the government's covering up the alien bodies in Roswell. Okay, how do you know that? Well, because they keep them secret and we can't go in there. And in other words, we have no evidence because there is no evidence. That's a tautology. We need actual physical evidence of this.
Well, okay, so the 2001 World Trade Center attack, sort of related to there's a lot of people, they go along with the let it happen theory there. Sort of basically it is that, they think of all the warnings that the U.S.
Oh, okay.
In your book here, you list things that Al-Qaeda has done.
Yeah.
And you list about 10 different things that they did before the 2001 attack. Mm-hmm. So there's certainly plenty of reason to be wary of Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. And there were so many warnings. I've got a whole bunch of them here. I could just...
But do you have the warnings for other things that did not happen?
Well, I mean...
Because we have to focus not just on the hits, but the misses.
Well, this is a judgment thing. It's like, there's a French Secret Service did 9 reports on this between 2000 and 2001. Judith Miller, who I don't know is very reliable, but she says the story she wrote was spiked. There was this Able Danger incident that had concerned a congressman. There was the FBI Phoenix memo. There was a memo from Colleen Rowley, who was an FBI agent in Minneapolis, dealing with this Massawi guy who wanted to take flying lessons. There were warnings from Egyptian intelligence, from Jordan, possibly from Morocco. There was this ex-CIA agent, Robert Baer, who wrote a book called See No Evil.
Yeah, but it's one thing to know or anticipate that Al-Qaeda is going to do something somewhere that's really bad. Mm-hmm. Yes, of course. Everybody was aware of that. Clinton, spent 8 years trying to get Osama bin Laden. It's not like that was a surprise. Mm-hmm. That's not the surprise. The surprise is the date, the time, and the method. There was no warning about that. Mm-hmm. The most we have is the August 9th memo that Condoleezza Rice got about Al-Qaeda will attack the United States and the United States soil. That doesn't tell us anything.
Well, that was just one of them. I mean, there was also Mossad apparently sent agents to personally warn people in the U.S. government about these coming attacks. And also there's a very strange story, the Odigo story. Odigo is imaging company or something. It had his office in one office in Tel Aviv and one in New York. And 2 hours before the attack, Odigo employees in New York got a phone call warning them that this was going to happen. And they didn't think anything of it until it actually did happen, and then they reported it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of supposed to be looked into. I don't know what the final outcome of that was.
Well, we know of many Al-Qaeda plots that have been thwarted. Mm-hmm. And so why did the government not let those happen?
Well, that's a good question, too. But a lot of people, and like I said, this is a sort of a judgment thing. You think that with all these warnings,
Do you think the British let the London bombings happen? Do you think the Spanish let the Lisbon bombings happen? Do you think the U.S. Navy let the USS Cole get attacked?
Well, I'd have to...
I mean, once you go down that road, you see what I'm saying? Once you go down the conspiratorial road, then what else would be true? If a plane didn't hit the Pentagon and it was a cruise missile, where's the plane?
Oh, I think it was a plane.
Okay.
It was a plane, no.
And
I sort of wonder how the plane, some people say, how did this pilot, who apparently was some not very well-trained... Arabian hijacker, how did he manage to do this very intricate maneuver and fly into the Pentagon at 400 miles an hour, 10 feet off the ground? People really wonder about that.
Okay, but wondering about is one thing. Thinking that implies something else is a whole different thing.
Well, you don't have to apply any. You can ask, and you can seek answers, and if you don't get an answer, then you sort of have to file it away somehow.
Yes, but just because you and I can't figure out how we might fly a plane, obviously there are plenty of pilots that can do that, and maybe this guy got just enough training, didn't have to spend any time figuring out how to land. All he had to do was figure out how to fly it. I have no problems thinking about how that could be done. I think that could be easily done.
Well, you're not a pilot, I'm not a pilot.
Right, so I think that, the Occam's razor, let's take this, the simplest, most straightforward explanation. And no more until there's evidence to think otherwise. Well, and again, like with the Lincoln assassination, Watergate thing, this is usually what happens in conspiracies. They're not perfectly run oiled machines that come off. They're bumbling, fumbling, chaotic events that people screw up and they tell other people. We find out about it. That's how conspiracies actually work.
Well. Like I said, I think this, this let it happen theory is a matter of judgment. You ask yourself, how many warnings can be kind of ignored or lost in the shuffle or whatever? But I think a lot of people...
Oh, I don't have any problems thinking about that.
They strongly suspect that like the 93 attack, where they knew it was going to happen and they allowed it to happen, that maybe some people, doesn't have to be a whole lot of people, let this one happen. They had no idea that it would be as horrible as it turned out to be.
Mm-hmm. So if they didn't know it was going to be horrible, then why would they let it happen?
Well, they thought it would be horrible enough to kind of arouse the public and accomplish their political ends.
Remember, they accused Roosevelt of this, letting Pearl Harbor happen.
Well, I got a book on that, too.
Oh, I know.
I don't know.
I've read all those. I'm not convinced.
You know, I mean, they present evidence. They don't make it up out of whole cloth.
But again, it's hindsight bias. Once you know what happened, it's easy to go back and pick out the causal chain and go, look, they should have seen this. They should have done that. And therefore, they didn't. And they didn't, therefore, they must have known it was going to happen. They let it happen. No, it's hard to know what's going to happen when you're in the present. After the fact, it's easy to figure out what you should have anticipated and then point fingers of blame.
Well, that's what history is all about. You know, you do that.
I know, but that doesn't make it real.
Well, let me take one more conspiracy notion.
Okay.
Yeah, well, this is the Martin Luther King assassination.
Oh, yeah, okay. I haven't read that much about the Martin Luther King.
Oh, well, here we have a case where a person actually did confess to being part of this plot. He says that he was given $100,000 by a Memphis produce dealer who got it from the New Orleans Mafia, and then he set up the whole thing. He confessed this. The King family came to believe that James Earl Ray was innocent. They filed a civil lawsuit against this man, and they actually, a jury ruled, it was a civil case, evidence a little bit different, but they ruled that this was a conspiracy of one involving this man, Lloyd Jowers, and other persons unknown.
He was in jail, right?
No, he was the cafe owner.
Oh, right.
And he says that actually the shooter was in the back bushes, in the backyard, and handed him the rifle, and he sort of got rid of it and was picked up later on. But so you have a certain amount of evidence. You have a jury verdict. You have actually the BBC put on a sort of a television trial. They try to make it as real as possible with a real judge, real prosecutors, jury selected, and they had witnesses and all that. And that jury did rule that it was a conspiracy. So there you have some evidence,
Okay, well, yeah, maybe. It could be.
And the thing that amazes me is that it was actually, the story was in the papers. You know, they didn't just bury it. They didn't play it on the front page, but it was, they reported the story, and then it was just kind of, ho-hum. That was it, you know? So how do we deal with those kind of things?
Well, you deal with them by looking at them case by case and looking at the evidence, and always remember Occam's razor and my principles that I put in my my chapter in The Believing Brain and Conspiracies, that the more people that have to be involved, the more components involved, they have to come together at the right time, at the right place, perfectly oiled machine, the less likely the theory is to be true. So your Martin Luther King one, okay, so it's just one other person. Okay, maybe. That's possible.
Actually, you know, Occam, I was William of Occam, who was a Franciscan monk, for what it's worth.
Yeah.
And I've always wondered, you know, I used to take a lot of philosophy classes, and the whole idea of Occam's razor, you know, is like sometimes you can say that, you know, maybe in some ways the conspiracy theory is the simplest version.
Sometimes.
You know?
Maybe.
So, anyway, boy, this has been a really lively, fascinating discussion.
I
wish we could go on longer, but this has been Fight the Empire. We've been talking about conspiracy theories with Michael Shermer, who is the author of The Believing Brain. And this book is about, you know, the conspiracy theories are just one chapter in this very interesting book. And I sort of focus on it because that's what this program is partly about. But there's a lot of interesting stuff on scientific knowledge and the whole mind-brain thing for philosophers. A lot of stuff in there for psychologists and everybody else. Well, Michael Shermer, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome, and thanks for having me.
Well, maybe sometime we could talk about philosophy and
we'll
all
have,
that.
We'll have a beer and discuss conspiracies and philosophy. Sounds good.
Sometimes I think philosophy is a conspiracy to bore people to death. But anyway, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
And stay tuned for KBOO, Always Something Good on KBOO, your radio station.